Live from Chicago, this is Open Line. Tonight, we'd like your input on another interesting topic of discussion. Simply call us at 312-329-4460. Let the connection ring. Guest host for tonight's Open Line, Greg Wheatley.
Good evening, everyone. Say the word evolution in the hearing of scientists, and you've spoken the word that most of them assume explains what we see around us. Say the same word in a group of evangelical Christians, and you're sure to raise some ire. Is evolution a fact of science? Do Christians who hold to a creationist viewpoint need to cower in the face of so-called scientific evidence? Our guest tonight is Philip Johnson, who says, wait a minute, evolutionists may not be quite as scientific as they claim. In fact, their suppositions may involve some faith as well. Our guest is Philip Johnson, who is a graduate of Harvard and also the University of Chicago. Philip is a former law clerk for Chief Justice Earl Warren. He taught law for over 20 years at the University of California at Berkeley. Still do. And still does, as a matter of fact. Welcome, Philip.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you on Open Line. What is a nice lawyer like you doing dabbling in the evolution debate, anyway?
Well, you know, I come from one of the world's great science universities in Berkeley, California, and I have a lot of colleagues and friends who are scientists, and I read a great deal on the subject of evolution. All the leading authorities of neo-Darwinism, that's the name for the officially sponsored evolutionary theory of today, all the great names in this field have written books for the general public. And the theme of those books has been, this is so obviously true that if you're intelligent at all, if you have any claim to be educated, then you ought to believe in what we're telling you. Now, I wasn't convinced, and so I decided to write a book to explain to them why I'm not convinced. Unfortunately, I had a year in London, England, while I was a visiting professor at London University, where I could do the initial research and writing for the book.
You are really coming at this, then, more from a logical, legal, what are we doing with the language kind of thing, than you are from a scientific viewpoint. Is that correct?
Well, I'd like to say, not that it's a legal standpoint, but it's a common sense view. It has to do with making sure our logic is straight, that our thinking is straight, and above all, making sure that we define our terms carefully. Because what I discovered is that very simple terms, when they get in the hands of Darwinists, change their meaning very rapidly on you, and so that you're trapped into believing something without really considering the evidence.
I want to get you to help us on those terms in just a minute. First, I want to tell people that you've written the book called Darwin on Trial. It's a fairly recent release, and
it came out in June.
There's an interesting story about the publishers on this that I want you to help us with. This is co-published by Regnery Gateway and also by InterVarsity Press. You want to explain that?
Regnery Gateway is a small publisher in Washington, D.C., which does largely books having to do with politics and government and some philosophy. And they're the main publisher that I really had the contract with. InterVarsity Press, and here near Lawrence Grove, I think, Illinois, a Christian publisher, was also very interested in being involved. And they made an arrangement with Regnery Gateway to take 5,000 copies out of the first print, I think, and distribute those to the Christian bookstore market. So if you buy the book in a Christian bookstore, it'll say InterVarsity Press on it. And if you buy it in a secular bookstore, it'll say Regnery Gateway on it. And that's the most unusual arrangement
Same insides, same cover.
It's exactly the same book, and the cover looks just the same. It's just the name of the publisher on the title page.
Well, we're not here to promote any particular publisher, so get the book as you choose to get it.
Sometimes you really have to order it. The publicity has been great and sales have been great. It's in the second printing already, but the stores often don't have it, and I'm hoping people will help influence those stores to keep the copies on hand.
Right. Again, it's called Darwin on Trial. It's got big red letters on the front. You can't miss it. And a picture of a guy that I assume is Charles Darwin.
That's him.
Got to be the
not
man.
Me.
No, I can see that. Charles Darwin on the front. And again, it's published either by Regnery Gateway or by InterVarsity Press. I'd love to have you folks get in on this tonight. You may be of a scientific bent. You may not be. I'm hoping, because I'm not, that this ends up being a layman's conversation. And I'm trusting that Philip is going to keep things on my level tonight. Philip, if you do that, we'll be okay, because I'm not a scientist.
Well, I'm supposed to be able to do that, so we'll see how well I do.
You get in on this by calling us at 312-329-4460. 312-329-4460. Philip, some terms to start with. Evolution.
Yes, why is evolution such a controversial term? It's used in several senses, which get very confusing. First, there's microevolution, that is small-scale change. If, for example, you're taking a lot of penicillin, the bacteria, the germs in your body will develop a resistance to this because the germs which are susceptible to penicillin die off, and the ones that are left are the ones that are resistant. And eventually the whole population becomes resistant, and that's why penicillin doesn't work as well today as it used to. Now that's evolution of a kind, but it has nothing to do with changing one of those bacteria, one of those germs, into something else. It's simply small-scale change within the type. And similarly, a more common example, dog breeding or pigeon breeding or orchid breeding, rose cultivation, you get different colors of plants. You get different sizes and shapes of dogs, but all dogs are one species. You don't change dogs into something fundamentally different. And that's not just because you don't have enough time. It's because long before you run out of time, you run out of variation, even though, as we know, the dog type has a relatively large capacity for variation. So that's microevolution. And one of the things that you'll be told is, well, you believe in evolution, don't you? You've seen there are different kinds of dogs, and you've seen that germs develop resistance to penicillin. So you believe in evolution, and so you see evolution created everything from nothing, and so there was never anything for God to do, and so we now have explained everything. But that's just a fast shuffle. That's just a deception. Now, another meaning of evolution, one that's often been used by defenders of the orthodox scientific theory in debates with me, they'll say, well, things change. Well, of course they do, but that's pretty vague. And then there's been change over time, so that then if you try to get them to be more specific, they'll say, well, the Earth's been around for a very long time, and there's been some process of slow and gradual change from simple to complex things. Well, now, depending on how specific they get, evolution in this sense would pose a problem for the person who interprets the Genesis creation story literally and insists that everything took place in 6 days over a relatively recent period. But it wouldn't in any way be inconsistent with, let us say, theistic religion in general, or a broad notion of creation as something that a creator did for a purpose. You see, God, in this sense, could have used a long gradual process over billions of years to create man for a purpose, and it would still be creation.
Let me stop you right there, because in your book you do seem to intimate and indicate that you would fall into that second camp rather than the first. Would I be fair in calling you, I don't know if you like labels or not, would I be fair in calling you a theistic? Would you be comfortable with theistic evolution?
No, I wouldn't, and I'll be glad to explain why. I'm not comfortable with any term which uses the word evolution in it, just because it's so vague and it changes. And I'll explain why I'm not comfortable with that term. And actually, you know, my position on the question of the biblical issues, or, you know, literal or figurative reading of Genesis or whatever, is that's outside the scope of my work. There are plenty of able people arguing that question.
That's not what you
and mean. I'll leave them to argue it, and I really don't want to take it up, because I've got plenty to do just handling biological evolution and pre-biological or chemical evolution. But to refer to your point about, am I a theistic evolutionist, and why wouldn't I want to use that term? Well, in particular, it's because there's a third meaning of evolution which comes in and is sneaked in after perhaps you've agreed to one of the, you know, microevolution or just over a long period of time. And this is the way the term is used in contemporary scientific language. When they say evolution, they mean a totally purposeless process in which all the creative work was done by random genetic changes like mutations, and the only shaping force was natural selection, the survival of the fittest. which just means that some things live longer than others and leave more offspring, more children, more descendants than others. And this is all that you need to create life in the first place from non-living chemicals, and then from the simplest bacterial cell, just a germ, to create trees and flowers and birds and monkeys and human beings and all of those things. So that there never was anything for a creator to do. The creator is totally unnecessary, and so you might as well forget about the creator.
No purpose or design.
No purpose or design. Okay. So, now, you see, a theistic evolutionist would be somebody who said, I guess if you took the theistic, says there's a creator who did all of this gradually, presumably, for a purpose, and there's a design to it. But evolution in the scientific sense absolutely rules out the possibility of design.
So you've got contradictory terms.
So it's contradictory.
Okay.
Now, of course, many people don't realize that, because they think that they're just saying, well, that God did this creating over a long period of time. But they're using a term that the scientists use in a different sense, and that's very confusing.
Okay, what do you think? Philip Johnson is here to take your questions or your comments at 312-329-4460. When we come back, your calls on Open Line. Philip Johnson is our guest. He's the author of Darwin on Trial, co-published by Regnery Gateway or InterVarsity Press. And we're going to go right to our phone calls tonight at 312-329-4460. Grand Rapids, Michigan. Sebring, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Go right ahead. You're on the air.
All right. I would like to bring up the fact that something from nothing is not a rational proposition. We are accused as Christians of assuming that God exists and that they, the evolutionists, do not assume anything. Well, you cannot begin from nothing without some kind of an assumption. So they assume that nothing plus nobody equals everything. Now, how, in the light of the first law of thermodynamics, is that a rational type of approach?
Okay, Philip, first of all, let me have you, is that a correct assessment of what evolutionists believe?
Well, they hold as a matter of faith, the way I would put it is, as a matter of faith, they say, since there never was any creator or anything supernatural, purely natural processes created all this complexity of life out of non-living matter.
All right.
And I guess eventually out of nothing.
Okay, I was going to say, as a simpleton here, let me ask, where did the non-living matter come from in their scheme?
That leads one into physics eventually. Either it was always there, or it came out of quantum fluctuations or something like that. There isn't really any satisfactory explanation for that, but that's not my subject. I'm dealing with the start of life on up from there.
Okay. So, Sebring, what you're saying is... anything that an evolutionist would say would fly in the face of this first law of thermodynamics.
That's exactly right. And
well,
that's scientific, and that's probably the strongest of the scientific laws that science knows anything about.
Well, I address this problem of the origin of life in Chapter 8 of my book.
I'm reading your book.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. By the way, I was just recently in your city of Grand Rapids for the first time, visited people there and had a very good time.
I was a professor at Calvin College for years.
I was just meeting with Howard Van Til there, a professor.
Well, he's a good close friend of mine.
Now, in my chapter on this, I make the point that the Darwinist evolutionary theory of biological evolution is really the key starting point for scientists in speculating about how life began, because they hold this faith that since natural selection can do all these wonders of creativity once you have life started, that it could in some way could also work at the pre-biological stage just among chemicals, or that somehow they could get this process jump-started. And what gives them all the confidence that they're about to solve this problem is that they feel that if they could just get one little tiny piece of a living thing started, then natural selection would do all the creating from there.
Well,
and they fail again and again and again, and yet they continue to hold this faith because they do make that powerful assumption, as the gentleman said.
It is, in effect, their leap of faith.
Yes. I think, you know, sometimes I say that I'm a believer in God because I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. That is to say, the faith that out of purely random motions of materials, you can create something as wonderful and complex as life. You know, even the simplest bacterial cell is a masterpiece of a miniaturized complexity. It has many, many complex things that all have to work together. And there's nothing but the faith of the evolutionary biologist or pre-biological evolutionists in this case, that makes them think that they can do this trick out of just the random motions of particles.
Sebring, thanks for your call tonight.
You're welcome.
All right, bye-bye. Let's go to Missoula, Montana. Hi, Bill.
How you doing?
Fine. Go right ahead.
I understand that Darwin recanted his belief in the theory of evolution before he died, and I wonder, number one, if you could confirm that, number two, if you knew of a good biography of Darwin that I could use as a source for that.
There's been a persistent story, especially in Christian circles, that Darwin recanted, but to the best of my information, it really hasn't been authenticated, and frankly, I don't believe it. But I don't claim to have tracked down all the evidence, so I won't insist on that if somebody is better informed. But for a biography, I would particularly recommend the biography of Darwin by Gertrude Himmelfarb, H-I-M-M-E-L-F-A-R-B, which was published in 1959, and is... Mrs. Himmelfarb is a prominent historian of the 19th century, intellectual historian, and she really is much less reverent and more objective in assessing Darwin than most other biographers have been, who would do it as if it was a life of one of the saints, you know. He is a saint to his faith, yeah.
But you've never run across a biography that specifically says that he recanted then?
I've seen reference to it in some sources, but... as I say, it seems to me the best informed people, it's based on hearsay. It's not well authenticated. And I really doubt that it's true. I think it's perhaps wishful thinking on parts of some of the opponents of evolution.
Okay, Bill?
Thank you.
Thanks for your call tonight.
You bet.
Let's go to State College, Pennsylvania, listener to WTLR. Hi, Mike.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Go right ahead. You're on the air with Philip.
Thank you. The only thing with the whole creation versus evolution that I have yet to settle in my own mind is the fossil record, which seems to, most of the fossils seem to predate possibly the age of Noah. And where does the fossil record fit in with the with Noah's flood? Because perhaps they exist, but I'm not aware of any fossils of pigs and chickens and cows and horses and dogs and cats.
Okay. What's all the big deal with fossils?
All right. Well, I have three chapters on the fossils, but I have to say that they do not answer the gentleman's question, and I'm not going to try to answer it because I do not go into the subject of dating. For purposes of my book, I accept simply as an assumption the official scientific story that the Earth is 4.6 billion years old and that the fossils were laid down over a very long period of time. I don't purport to go into the evidence on that because my interest really is in the question of whether you can do the job of creating by mutations and selection or whatever, because I regard that as much more important than the question of how long it took, of how was it done. Now, what we see in the fossil evidence is that any theory of evolution that is Darwinistic, that is, that rests on the notion that tiny step-by-step changes, small mutations guided by natural selection, did all of this creating, is absolutely at odds with the fossil record. Because what the fossil record shows consistently is that when things appear in the rocks, they're fully formed, and they stay the same thereafter. Some things, like cockroaches and sharks, have stayed the same for hundreds of millions of years, while other things, not so very different from them, were supposedly evolving into amphibians and reptiles and human beings. Yet they stay the same through all of these vast climactic changes and environmental changes that supposedly produce rapid evolution. So the fossil record has been an embarrassment to Darwinists from the start because it just doesn't comport with their predictions at all. But I don't go into the dating or the question of Noah's flood.
All right,
okay, Mike. Hey, thanks for calling. 312-329-4460. Philip, before we go to our next call, I was looking through your book and I came across what to me was an incredible quote from a guy I'd never heard of, Stephen Jay Gould. Maybe in a minute.
Oh, he's a very prominent Harvard professor.
He must be.
Professor of science.
I have never heard of him, but let me just, this will take a second, but let me read this and have you react to it. Stephen Jay Gould, facts are the world's data. Theories are structures of ideas that explain and interpret facts. Facts do not go away while scientists debate rival theories for explaining them. Einstein's theory of gravitation replaced Newton's, but apples did not suspend themselves in midair pending the outcome. And, says Gould, human beings evolved from ape-like ancestors, whether they did so by Darwin's proposed mechanism or by some other yet to be identified. The first part of that, I don't think we have any problem with. How does Gould make the leap to assume that he knows, he's assuming a priori, that man descended from apes?
Yes. Well, you see, to the Darwinist mind, that process of biological descent, it just seems so self-evident that they think of it as a fact. Now, this is the subject of Chapter 5 of my book, by the way, if people really want to see this laid out. But I can tell you a story which isn't in my book that'll perhaps illustrate it. I had a faculty colloquium that I led at the University of California at Berkeley. I invite law professors, scientists, and so on. And there was a very prominent evolutionary biologist who came to debate me there named Vincent Sarich. Professor Sarich was so upset that there were doubters about Darwinistic evolution among the people present here in this great university. I mean, everybody ought to believe. That he said, well, I'm going to explain this to you so you'll get it once and for all. And he picked up a bottle cap and he dropped it on the floor. And he said, you see, this fell down. You see, that's gravity. The apples fall down and not up. He said, there was Einstein. There was Newton's theory of gravity, and then there's Einstein, but the thing still falls down. Now, that's the fact of gravity. And he said, and it's just as much a fact of gravity as gravity, that all mammals had a common ancestor in the Cretaceous period, a couple hundred million years ago, from whom they descended, 100 million years ago. Now, you see, you can't see that common ancestor. You can't find it in the fossil record. You can't identify the descendants that are between that common ancestor and us. But it's so vivid in this man's imagination that he sees it as a fact, just like that object that he's dropping. And that's why people whose minds have been trained that way, when they read my book or a similar a book that questions what they believe so fervently, they just can't understand it. When I was on Wisconsin Public Radio yesterday on a debate with a woman named Eugenie Scott, who's sort of a creationist fighter by profession, when I challenged whether natural selection could do all the job of creating, and she was asked to give a response as to how, she knew. She said in a very, a patronizing tone, we just put that aside years ago. We never talk about that anymore. We all decided it was true, and we just know that, and it's something we don't talk anymore. Well, you see, she cannot believe that somebody is serious in questioning that, because her mind has been formed by so many years of indoctrination that it's just something that is beyond the power of reason. It's so obvious that you must be insane if you question it. And Darwinists will often say, even, they'll speak of people who pretend not to believe in their theory because they just can't believe that they really don't believe it. That's what I call mind control.
312-329-4460, Philip Johnson, our guest. His book is Darwin on Trial, and you can get in on this tonight by calling us. Let's go to Baltimore and talk with Charlene. Hi, Charlene.
Hi. I just recently read an article about 3 or 4 months ago that scientists have proved through extensive research that mankind has evolved, come down through the ages, from one woman. Okay, one woman meaning one Homo sapien. What effect has that had on the evolution theory?
Well, this is a reference to the mitochondrial Eve hypothesis.
Yeah.
Which was developed by Professor Alan Wilson at my University of California at Berkeley, actually, recently deceased, who worked closely on other matters with the very Professor Vincent Sarich I've just mentioned, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And this was done not by any kind of historical research or fossils or anything. Wilson is a biochemist. And they have a very elaborate theory about differences in certain mitochondrial molecules between people of different places. They assume evolution throughout it, and this enables them, by making a lot of powerful assumptions, to place the time and place from which humanity came. I wouldn't be too worried about that or take it too seriously, because there are many other scientists who are bitterly opposed to the whole idea. And while it's been fashionable for the last few years, it may be forgotten in another 10 years, or, it wouldn't surprise me. They call it mitochondrial Eve, and when Newsweek did a story about this, they had Adam and Eve and the serpent and the apple on the cover.
Right,
it was very funny.
Is it being taken seriously by the scientific community?
Oh, yes, but it's controversial. It's one of these things, I would describe it myself as brilliant guesswork.
Yeah.
It depends very heavily on a lot of powerful assumptions, any or all of which could be wrong. So you can't really say it's anything that somebody ought to rely on. But it was a clever piece of biochemistry.
Okay, so basically it was just good guesswork by evolution. It supports the evolution theory. It doesn't disprove it.
Well, it's an assumption of evolution anyway. They assume that from the start, so they can't prove it or disprove it because it's built into their assumptions at the beginning.
So they don't worry about it, right?
Well, you see, if you're in biological science in any capacity,
yeah.
You are not just a believer in biological evolution and step-by-step descent, but you never have thought of doubting it. If you begin to express doubts, you're unreliable and you won't be in science for very long because you need to get research grants, you need to get the approval of your fellow scientists, and you won't have it.
Well, I'd like to make one more statement that I made to a professor at college.
Real quickly, Charlotte.
He said that we had all descended from apes, and I said, well, you may descend from apes, but I'd like to prefer to think that I'm a special creation of God.
Mm. Hey, Charlene, we got to run and take a break. Thanks for your call.
Bye.
We're talking with Philip Johnson, and he's written the book Darwin on Trial. We'll be back with more, and hopefully your calls. Maybe you're an evolutionist. Maybe you don't agree with this particular viewpoint. You call, too.
Guest host for this evening's edition of Open Line.
Philip Johnson is our guest tonight on Open Line, and by the way, I'm Greg Wheatley for Chris Fabry. Chris is on assignment in Wichita, Kansas, preparing a documentary that we think is going to be an important one on Operation Rescue going on in Wichita. That will air in this time slot next Tuesday and Wednesday evening, so I hope you'll make plans to be around and hear that. If you can't be around, maybe get your tape recorder running and get it on tape. Philip Johnson has written the book Darwin on Trial, co-published by Regnery Gateway and by InterVarsity Press, and we're going to go back to the phones now, waiting for your call at 312-329-4460. WMBI listener Bob is in Lombard. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Greg. I want to compliment Dr. Johnson for an excellent book. I'm reading it now. I have some background in biology, and I would classify myself as a theistic evolutionist. And I don't think his book destroys that idea, but he certainly brings out the salient points and the weaknesses of traditional Darwinian evolution. The one in particular is this massive influx of new species after a catastrophe, which Darwinian theorists simply don't even tackle. They have no way of knowing this, and Dr. Johnson brings out this point very well in the book. I'm wondering if, I used to teach science in school, I'm wondering if this book might enter a court battle and be taught right alongside of schools that teach the traditional Darwinian evolution. Him being a lawyer, he might have some ideas as to what direction that might take. And one other thing, Greg, I'd like to say, you ought to read the first tribute given to Dr. Johnson and on the back cover of the book by Dr. Michael Denton. Molecular biologist. I think it's newsworthy.
Okay. Well, let's look at that right now. Michael Denton is the author of Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, and says, Darwin on Trial is unquestionably the best critique of Darwinism I've ever read. Professor Johnson combines a broad knowledge of biology with the incisive logic of a leading legal scholar to deliver a brilliant and devastating attack on the whole edifice of Darwinian belief. No doubt that this book will prove a severe embarrassment to the Darwinian establishment. That is quite an accolade.
Well, it was very nice to receive, particularly from Michael Denton, who's written a fine book himself and is a molecular biologist from Australia. He spent 3 days with me in California discussing all these issues while I was working on the book.
What about this school issue thing? What about the courts and the schools and this whole thing?
Well, it makes me take a deep breath because I do have a lot to say about that, but there is a lot to say. It's complicated. I think a misguided, an effort that really wasn't well judged was tried at one time, you know, to get balanced time for creation science in the schools. And the trouble, I think, with the attempt was that the lawyers, the courts, all viewed it as essentially tied to the biblical account of creation. and as an attempt to bring a totally different kind of evidence in the into the science classes, that is the Bible, rather than fossils and experiments and that sort of thing. And they were dead against that. I regard that as bringing religion into science, and ruled it unconstitutional. And the creation science movement was unable to escape this kind of a label. Now, the Darwinist fraternity and the people that run science education have sort of taken these legal decisions as a cue to say that we can ban any consideration whatever of anything that's contrary to the official theory. So that some really very moderate and reasonable attempts just to raise questions about Darwinism have been banned from the schools. For example, the American Scientific Affiliation, which is a theistic evolution group in many ways, although that's but I'll describe only some of the people in it, put out a pamphlet for schools that just said there are certain unsolved problems, that we don't really know how all these bursts of new great activity occurred and that sort of thing. And it was just banned from the schools completely. And they said, well, these people are just as bad as the biblical fundamentalists that we banned previously. In fact, they're even worse because they pretend not to be relying on the Bible and to be bringing all these science. And we know they must be lying because how could anybody doubt what we believe, you know, in Darwinism if they weren't relying on something outside of science. So there's been a tremendous difficulty in getting any open-mindedness at all. You know, a professor at the University of Alabama was recently ordered to stop telling his classes that he doubted the truth of Darwinistic evolution, and to stop even inviting them to an after-hours session, not a formal class at all, at which he would discuss why he thought that the human body was so complex and so wonderfully designed that it required a designer, based on scientific evidence in physiology, which was what he was teaching. Now, I hope that the Supreme Court of the United States is going to hear that case and look at this from the standpoint of free speech and civil liberties. But it's a big uphill battle, because a very dogmatic group of people is in charge of science education in this country. They will not allow any approach except their own. And they have been able to confuse and mislead the media so much so that they get people thinking that the people who want to raise doubts about Darwinism are somehow, fanatics trying to force their opinions on other people, whereas really what they're trying to do is to get a fair hearing for dissent. So we have to do a lot of work to try to re-educate the intellectuals of the country and the media so that they understand what's really going on, that there are reasonable grounds for doubt here, and that they ought to be given a fair hearing. And that's, I guess, in a nutshell, what I'm trying to do with this book.
Thanks, Bob, for your call. Appreciate that tonight. Okay. This might be a good spot, Philip, to bring up, I think you make a distinction in creation science and creationism.
Mm-hmm.
Can you sort of speak to that and help us understand what's different about those in your mind?
Well, the creation science movement is something which has existed for a number of years now, and it is very much tied to the young Earth position, the position that the Earth is perhaps 6,000 or no more than 10,000 years old, and that all creation occurred during a single week. And this position is, of course, tied to the Genesis account. And that's the position that the Supreme Court has held, that could not be given equal time in the schools. Now, many people identify any mention of creation with the specific positions of this creation science movement. But I try to explain that creation is a much broader concept than that. That even people who say they believe in evolution, but think of it as God's means of bringing about human beings over a long period of time, are really creationists in the eyes of the scientific establishment. Because you see, if God did anything to direct this process, then you have a creator, and belief in a creator is what creationism is.
And you're clearly out of the Darwinist camp at that point.
Yes. Now, if you define creation and creationism broadly, as I do, then at least 80% and probably 90% of the American public is creationist. You see, not just the ones who hold to a literal interpretation of Genesis. Now, you see, the scientific establishment, the Darwinist establishment, tries to keep people confused on this. In the first place, they say that the only people that oppose us are the biblical literalists, and they just won't look at the scientific evidence or be open-minded about it. But then anybody who doubts the truth of their theory and who thinks that a creator had anything to do with it is labeled as a creationist too, and thus by implication as a biblical literalist. So it's a constant fast shuffle of the terms, really. And I'm trying to clarify this. So the position that a creator brought about living forms and eventually human beings for a purpose is a very broad notion. It has nothing necessarily to do with the Bible, although it is what's taught in the Bible, and it's what most people believe. And I think it's a secondary question, although it may be very important to many people, it's a secondary question how long it took.
What about young Earth, Philip? You alluded to that. How do you feel about it? Why or why not? Justify your thinking on that. Do we have to have a young Earth to be creationists?
Well, no. As I say, I even within very conservative Christian camps, there's quite a bit of difference of opinion about that. You know, William Jennings Bryan, the three times presidential candidate who appeared in the Scopes trial. I retell the story of the Scopes trial in Chapter 1, which has come down to us as a great triumph of Darwinism, but really wasn't quite, if you look at all the facts. Well, William Jennings Bryan there got on the stand as an expert on creation. And he said that he believed that the days of the, referred to in Genesis, were very long periods of time, and not literal days. That got him in trouble, of course, with some of his own following. Well, I'm not having anything to do with that issue, to tell you the truth. As I say, many people have fought over that, and let them continue to do so. My position is that what is important is to look at the official scientific theory that's being promoted as fact, see if the evidence supports it, see if it's really true, and see if it accords with creation in the broad sense. Now, after we've got all of that settled, and we've clarified all of those issues, then we have a long time, maybe all eternity, to have a good discussion of the other issues. But I'll stick with this one for now.
Okay. Philip Johnson, I don't think I could have put that any better myself. Darwin on Trial is the name of the book, and we'd love to hear from you at 312-329-4460. Back with more calls on Open Line in just a moment.
Talk with some of the leading thinkers in Christianity, the theologians, pastors, speakers, and Christian newsmakers. Or have you ever struggled with a difficult passage of Scripture? You've read and searched, but you can't find a satisfactory answer. The solution to your request is heard each weeknight on Open Line. Donald Cole takes those biblical questions and helps listeners on every level understand the Bible and what it means to our everyday life.
Tonight, and more than we're going to be able to get in here on our live program, we have just about 10 minutes or a little more left. We do this from time to time. We're going to keep the lines open after we go off the air tonight, so you keep calling if you haven't been able to get through. You can call right up until, 45 minutes from now, the bottom of the hour, and we'll record this, and it'll probably be heard at some later point. Probably sometime when Chris Fabry wants to take a vacation, we can play this pre-recorded program. But if you're not able to get in tonight on a regular program, keep calling this same number, and we will stay around. Philip has agreed to do that, and we'll record your comments and questions. 312-329-4460. Let's go to Baltimore and talk with Vermel. Hi, Vermel.
Hi.
You're on the air.
Okay. I'm a vice principal in a large suburban public school system, and it was just brought to my attention today by one of my teachers that a new science curriculum has been proposed for our seventh graders, for the county seventh graders. And my concern is that, well, it's already part of the high school curriculum, but these were older kids. The seventh graders, as you know, very impressionable, trying to find themselves, and all of a sudden having to be confronted with evolution as being the explanation as to, you know, why they're here. And my question to Dr. Johnson would be, short of my actually going to the school board, because I'm such a coward, I'm going to have to go there and confront my bosses, but short of doing that, are there some sources or materials that I can either send them or give to someone else to send them to more or less refute the legitimacy of evolution? And you know, how can I educate our school board to let them see all the holes in evolution? You know, these are the people who are going to be deciding about this curriculum.
Well, it's really tough, and I don't wonder that you're a little bit afraid of getting involved in the confrontation, because it doesn't mean you're a coward, but there are very powerful organizations of people who specialize in bullying teachers and parents who complain on this subject.
Right.
Just shouting them down and telling them they're fools and ignoramuses and never taking their questions seriously. This is how it's done. Now, besides my own book, which is, you know, I really aimed at doing a lot of the job that you're talking about, it really liberating people, helping them to get a sense that they understand it and that they know how to make objections, I've already referred to the American Scientific Affiliation pamphlet, which has been sent widely to school teachers, and is called Teaching Science in an Age of Controversy, that's really aimed at the high school teacher. There's also a book that has some virtues, and some people have been a little critical of, but is, I think, basically on the right track, called Of Pandas and People, which attempts to introduce the students to the question of the possibility that there is intelligent design rather than just random action in, you know, in living things. But the science professionals that control this area of education have fought, and so far successfully, to keep these books completely out of the classroom as much as they can, to keep them from being even mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Now, really, I think that the answer, you know, I hate to give you this answer, but I have to be honest, that I think that there's very little that anybody can do directly to fight this right now. That what the job that needs to be done right now is a tremendous amount of education within the Christian community, of course, but also within many other communities. You know, there are many people who are, of course, Jewish people,
mm-hmm.
Islamic people, God believers, even the people who have a vague notion of some creative force that they wouldn't think of as God, who are very annoyed at having this strong materialistic philosophy, naturalistic philosophy, crammed down their throats and their children's throats in the school. And so I think what we need to do is educate broadly a large number of people and form coalitions. You see, it can't be just conservative Protestant evangelicals who are objecting.
Right.
Catholics and Jewish parents and others have to be involved as well. They have to understand the issue well enough that they can make their complaints in a very reasonable and well-informed way. And I'm trying to help and do the groundwork so that that will be possible, that people will be liberated to do that. But I think we need a period of preparation right now. I'm afraid that individuals who just speak up will get bullied and steamrollered. I've seen it happen so often.
Or in my case, fired.
Yeah, that can happen too. Vermil, I hope that helps.
It helps a lot.
All right. Thank you. Thanks for your participation.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, Mike.
Hi. First, I wanted to make a suggestion to the caller who called earlier and asked about the fossil record. And if I can, there's two book titles that might really help him understand the fossil record.
All right, great.
Okay, one is The Remarkable Birth of Planet Earth by Dr. Morris, and the other would be It's a Young World After All. And I don't remember the author's name off the top of my head, but those are both real good books on that topic that would probably help him out.
Okay, do you have a question, too?
Yeah, I do. My question was that if the author is going to accept millions of years as just a almost kind of a given, which I may be misunderstanding, but it sounds to me like he's saying that it's almost a given or that we shouldn't really be too concerned with it, then why does he debate evolution? Because it seems to me that the whole purpose of the evolution debate is to destroy the Genesis account. They're trying to discount our faith in God, and yet in Genesis it tells us, you know, we have a 6,000-year genealogy, we have a six-day creation, the flood, the division of the continents, all the scientific evidence that I've ever seen appropriately presented confirms the actual literal account of the whole book of Genesis, and I've never really seen the evidence there to support millions of years, and I'm just curious if he's going to accept that, which is their biggest, their strongest premise towards evolution. Then why does he even bother the debate?
Okay, Philip. All right, well, to me, it's important to decide what's important. And I think this caller and I have a difference of opinion about what is most important. To me, what is most important is the question of creation itself. Are we here because we were designed and created, whether over a short period of time or a long one, by a creator who had a purpose for us and therefore whom we can have a relationship with, duties towards. That, to me, is the really important thing. Now, I don't believe that the authority of the Bible is destroyed. by the old Earth thesis at all. And as I say, there are many people who are very conservative in their approach to biblical authority who would agree with that. Now, then there are others who don't. And like many issues, there are different opinions on this. But to me, it's creation that's the important thing, not the number of years. Now, there's another point. It's been hard enough for somebody outside of a professional science to study all the fields you have to study to be able to make a really good case on the scientific evidence in evolutionary biology and pre-biological evolution. Most scientists are narrow specialists. To cover all of these fields, even in a general way, has been a tremendous amount of study. If I'm going to go into the geology, into the question of radioactive dating, into all of those questions, I've got a lot more work to do if I'm going to do it responsibly. I would have to say that as of now, the radiometric evidence of dating appears to indicate a very old Earth, and if that's false, I couldn't explain why it's false, because I simply do not have information that would justify me in doing that. Now, if somebody else does, they're very welcome to undertake that task. But I'm not going to go out and do battle with something unless I'm sure I know what the flaws in the theory are, and that requires a lot of study and work. So I've decided this is where I should go.
This is where your battle is. And I think, Mike, pardon me, Philip, if I'm misparaphrasing you, you can correct me. I think what you're saying is that your thesis of an old Earth, at least in your mind, does not do an injustice to a creator. You are able to reconcile the fact that there is a designer and a creator and still keep that in balance with an old Earth.
Well, I was just curious, I guess. I'm sure that the reason you believe that there's a creator is either because you learned it from the Bible or you have some personal relationship with God through Jesus Christ. Is that a good assumption?
That's certainly involved in my my personal position and my personal faith. But what I am doing in this book and really on this program is not talking about what is going on in my soul or in my heart, but what one can learn from the scientific evidence. And what I'm endeavoring to show is that the idea that these materialistic processes of mutation selection can do it all.
Wonderful and wonderfully full hour with Philip Johnson, who is the author of Darwin on Trial, published by Regnery Gateway and co-published by University Press, I might add. And because of the nature of this program and the tremendous interest and the great calls we had, we've decided to stick around, and the program you're hearing tonight has been pre-recorded, so unfortunately you'll not be able to call us as you hear this program, but I do hope you'll enjoy it and benefit from it. What, in a nutshell, are you trying to say in your book, Darwin on Trial?
Well, I'm trying to liberate people from the oppressive effect of a theory that is being proclaimed dogmatically with the use of loosely defined terms and bad logic, that is to say, the Darwinian or neo-Darwinian theory of evolution. I'm trying to teach people to think for themselves about this subject, to know enough about the evidence that they can see what the problems are with the theory, and especially so that they can protect themselves from the reasoning tricks, the shifting definitions, vague terms, the hidden assumptions that have supported this theory, because I think there's a great reason to be doubtful of it, and I think people should know the truth about it.
There is, I think you're saying, a tremendous vested interest in the scientific community as it relates to Darwinism. I asked you before, is it true that you are actually ousted from the scientific community if you don't espouse Darwinism? Is that a fair statement?
Well, if you were in something that had absolutely nothing to do with evolution, you kept your opinions fairly discreet, you might get by. But so you tried to make your way in biology. And expressed doubts about the theory of evolution or the creative power of natural selection. You would be considered incompetent and possibly insane, and of course you wouldn't get a job, you wouldn't get promoted, and you wouldn't get grants. People sometimes ask me why I, as a law professor, have taken this subject up and am writing about it. Well, one answer to that is it's hard for them to get at me. I don't have any grants, and in fact I have a lot of support among other professors of my kind, so I'm free to make a skeptical case and to raise doubts where people in biological science would not be. They're trained to think in terms of evolution. And it's a great indoctrination. After you've had enough of this kind of training, you see evolution everywhere because you're trained to see everything in evolutionary terms.
How long has this been going on? In terms of the, so to speak, brainwashing, is this a long-standing thing that Darwinism has been the accepted and the only accepted way to think?
What came in with Darwin was a philosophical position that I would call scientific naturalism. There have always been doubts about various parts of Darwin's theory, and there was a while up until about the 1920s when there was some ferment about the concept of natural selection, even in scientific circles. But it was considered that to be a scientist at all, you had to firmly disbelieve in the supernatural. You couldn't think of a creator outside of nature who started things that in any way interferes with natural events or communicates with human beings. With this way of thinking, it took hold, and it was thought that you had to be a naturalist to be a scientist at all. Then eventually all the possibilities except Darwinism were eliminated. Other forms of evolutionary theory sort of dropped out. So by about the 1930s, it became, to be in science was to be a Darwinist, to be in biological science. Now, this has been pretty much for science majors in college and professional scientists up till now. They haven't taught it very specifically in most schools. But right now, there is a tremendous effort to give every student in every public school a thorough indoctrination in Darwinist thinking. They call it giving them the scientific outlook, teaching them how science works. But essentially, it's meant to convert everybody to this position of philosophical naturalism by showing them that all the work of creation was done, could have been done, and actually was done by purely naturalistic, materialistic processes. So there never was anything for a God to do. And so, why bother about God? It isn't such that God doesn't exist, as that God never had anything useful to do.
He's irrelevant.
He's irrelevant.
One thing that has fascinated me, Philip, has been the fact that science, in its original form, was very much theocentric. Am I wrong?
Oh, absolutely. The war really started with Darwin. Because
that was the watershed.
Yeah. In fact, you see, the existence of God and God's active superintendence of things is the real metaphysical basis, philosophical basis, for expecting things to be orderly and understandable to our minds. When you get rid of the creator, you see, you get rid of the lawmaker. So you get rid of the idea of law. All you have is a certain phenomena you observe and certain regularities you observe, but what guarantee do you have that they hold in any general way? And in fact, now that in the universities God has been so thoroughly murdered, really, if that's the death of God that the philosophers talk of, we're getting into a situation where more and more nihilism, more and more universal disbelief, is creeping in, and it's eating away at the foundations of scientific thinking as well. It's one of the reasons why the universities are such confused places and such intolerant and hateful places in many ways these days.
Philip Johnson is our guest on Open Line, and again, this is a pre-recorded program, so unfortunately we're not going to be able to invite your calls tonight. He's written the book called Darwin on Trial, published by Regnery Gateway and also by InterVarsity Press. I found it interesting, Philip, the story about how your book came into being. Maybe you could share that with us briefly. Apparently you were... it's while you were at the University of California at Berkeley, and Christianity Today quotes a little anecdote about a lot of professors sitting around in a room, and they gathered to respond to an 83-page critique of Darwinism by one of their colleagues.
Well, that was immediately after I had come home from a year's sabbatical in London, England, where I'd had a visiting professorship at the University of London and no teaching duties. So I had a lot of time to devote to a research project and nothing very specific in mind. I passed London's largest scientific bookstore every morning on my way to work, and it just so happened that I got intrigued in one book after another on Darwinism. Well, I finally decided, you know, I'm getting so tired of seeing these slipshod arguments and these vague and evasive terms and all of this heavy-handed claim that they've proved things that they just assumed at the beginning, that I'm going to write a sort of a paper and answer all of this. And I produced a product that was too long to be just a scholarly paper, and too short to be a book. It was too scholarly to go to a popular magazine, and too much for the general reader, and it didn't fit in the legal scholarship. It was in between everything, so I didn't know what to do with it. And that's when I had a faculty seminar on that, invited scientists and everything, had a wonderful argument. The biologists were simply astonished that such a discussion could be held at the University of California. And then after that, I decided to turn it into a book, and I spent another 2 years doing the book and hunting a publisher, because this is a hard thing to get a respectable secular press to undertake.
Would they not do it?
Seriously, no.
would an academic publisher not touch it?
Absolutely not. You see, when one academic press considered doing it, they were warned that they would never get another scientific title, that they would be boycotted. The scientists who have responded to articles of mine have said, you know, no editor should ever allow a thing like this to be printed. I published a long article that is sort of a short version, consistent with the theme of the book, in a magazine called First Things. It's edited by a very prominent man named Richard John Newhouse, mm-hmm. who's very prominent in religious circles. And he wrote to me sometime afterward. He said, you know, we continue to get letters that denounce us for publishing your article without ever objecting to anything of substance in it. It's just that you are not supposed to do this. You see, it's the fundamental sacred cow of the intellectuals of our time, and they just won't see it a question. Well, more and more, I don't want to say that about all intellectuals, because, in fact, I'm now getting a lot of intellectuals on my side, including university professors, so I don't want to paint with too broad a brush there.
Philip Johnson is our guest. He's written Darwin on Trial, and we'll be back with more in just a moment.
Okay, great. The two fields of study that I'm interested in are biology and linguistics. And I was wondering if you could share with the audience the problem that the evolutionists have explaining DNA, and also the problem they have explaining how human language could possibly have evolved.
Well, those are both the big problems. You may well have some insights on this beyond what I have, because I don't claim to know everything about this subject. To take the language thing in the first place, it is something that's specific to humans, that comes in and is just very basic to our mental equipment, and you know, isn't found anywhere else. And is it's like many things about the human nature. It's just something altogether new that comes in with the human species, and there's nothing but ad hoc speculations as to how it might have occurred. Would you like to add to that? I want to ask the caller, because I think he probably has specific things in mind, and I'd like to hear him.
Well, it would just be something that, those would just be two questions. Well, first of all, on DNA, I can add a little bit that the smallest particle of life, of the smallest cell, consists of a DNA molecule that is tremendously complex. And so there's no explanation of how this complex thing, although very small, how it could all evolve instantaneously.
Yes.
And will all the parts fit together?
Well, this is a subject which I go into in Chapter 8 of my book on the origin of life, the pre-biological evolution. Because nowadays the orthodox view is that the fundamental job of the cell is the synthesis of proteins, which are very complex molecules. And to do that, you need the DNA, as the gentleman says, and then RNA, which takes the message from DNA and does the work of communicating the language for protein synthesis. And all of this is a vastly complex system. Now, what the scientists try to do is they try to figure out the simplest possible component of the thing that might conceivably have done something on its own, and then assume that Darwinist evolution, natural selection, can take it from there and can bring life all the way to its present state of complexity. And there really isn't any evidence for this. It's just a leap of faith for materialists, you might say.
Dave, is that helpful to you?
Yes, very good.
All right. Thanks for your call today. Let's go to Bayville, New Jersey, and talk with Chris. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. Good evening. Mr. Johnson.
Yes.
I certainly believe in creation. I'm a Christian, and I believe the biblical record. But all my questions aren't answered, and I know that all my questions won't be answered until that day when I know as I am known. But
quite right.
One thing that has troubled me, that I haven't been able to figure out, other than to put it into the gap, okay, is this question of time, the question of distance. When you look at the stars, you've got this tremendous distance and time thing that appears real. A trillion light years, okay? You know what I'm getting at?
Well, I'm not sure I do, because, you know, the official count of the age of the universe, from the Big Bang to the present, that's officially accepted, is 20 billion years at most.
Okay.
And while that's a long period of time, it isn't, in fact, anywhere near long enough for the really long odds chance events and the origin of life scenario and so on, so that, in fact, they have to then imagine maybe other universes or, to some really long shot to chance. So that they don't really add on time infinitely, I would say.
No. Well, I've wondered about the tohu abohu, the confusion, the period of time in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth became formless and void. There's some question about whether the terminology that we use in the earth was formless and void, or whether it became formless and void, the gap theory. And I know you can't use that to argue with your secular evolutionists. But in a sense, isn't our apologetic mainly geared to the believer, to help ground the believer in what creation really is?
Oh, all right. Now I think I do begin to understand what's troubling, and I'll give a shot at answering it.
Okay.
We'll see if I've got the question right when I give the answer. Maybe I won't. But what is troubling to the unbeliever when you talk to them? Now, I don't think that anybody ever really lost their faith over the age of the earth question, or the gap theory of the first two verses of Genesis, or any of those questions. That's why I don't put them primary. I don't think anybody became an atheist because, you know, they were convinced that the world was 4.6 billion years rather than 6,000. I think that Darwinism has a lot to do with making atheists. Atheism was a kind of an eccentric opinion before the triumph of Darwinism, and it became orthodoxy, at least in elite intellectual circles, after that. And the reason for that was that Darwinism left the creator with nothing to do. That it showed that the natural forces, or it claimed to show that the natural forces, could do all the work of creating. And more than that, I think, is that with Darwinism, a habit of mind came into the scientific profession and spread to other fields of study as well, that just as a matter of methodological approach ruled out God, the supernatural, creation just from the start, and made people used to thinking that these were just pre-rational ideas of no use. So that's where the real indoctrination came in. I think if we could solve this problem, if we could persuade people that, in fact, natural selection can't do all that creating, because the evidence that it can just isn't there. It's really a very bad theory, and I think this is doable. Then I think that, you know, it'd be interesting to talk about the long age of and how we fit this in with Genesis and all, but I don't think that's fundamental to very many people's faith.
Do you think we're actually seeing the crumbling of the theory of evolution?
Yes, I do. This may be wishful thinking on my part. After all, I'd like to think that my book's going to persuade people and other books like it. And
well, I'm going to buy it. I'm a homeschooler.
Okay.
I'm a homeschooler.
Good. But so I like to think that the time is right. And there are reasons why I believe that. One is I see a lot of intellectuals around me are really ready to listen. I'm by no means a lonely and isolated figure, even at the University of California at Berkeley, which is no Bible Belt college.
There can happen anywhere.
And I have a lot of friends and supporters on the faculty. In other countries, you know, in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union, the collapse of Marxism has involved more than just change in the political system, more than just change in the economic system.
So everything they've been taught has now been thrown out the window.
Yes, and Marxism was always based on the same kind of scientism that Darwinism was. So you find intellectuals in these countries that are very willing to do thinking about these fundamental issues that the intellectuals in our country, are trying to keep off
people's minds and to prevent them from consideration. Nowadays, you know, people go to the Soviet Union and they say it's much more open than our society in terms of speculation about these kinds of issues. It's allowed there where it isn't here, at least in any public stage. So I think it may be time when we can get some fundamental change in this area if we get enough people informed well enough.
Well, I certainly hope so, and I'm going to get your book.
All right. Hey, Chris.
I didn't know that.
Thank you for calling us.
You're very welcome.
All right.
Thank you.
Good day. Let me, before we go to our next call, Philip, he sort of jogged something in my memory. I think it was a book that I was supposed to have read back when I was in college, and one of those I didn't read but should have, by Jacques Barzun, called Darwin, Marx and Wagner,
yes.
What's the connection? Why the three lumped together?
Well, Barzun, who was a very prominent European scholar who'd come to Columbia University, he was the provost, the chief administrator of the university for a long time. He wrote this book because he saw the year 1859 as a great pivotal year in European intellectual history. In which Darwin was the central figure, the triumph of Darwin occurred, in which Marx published his seminal ideas in a paper, and which the cult of Wagner and its military heroism, a kind of thing that led eventually to the German militarism of the 20th century that was so tragic, all of these things really came to fruition. Barzun was really almost contemptuous of Darwin. He dissected his book and almost, ridiculed that he found it so poorly reasoned. You could see that even if this was at a period when Darwinism was at its height, and nobody could doubt it, but Barzun was so prominent he could get away with it. Unfortunately, it didn't have as much influence as perhaps it ought to have, but it's still widely read.
Well, how would you summarize, what's the common thread in those three men, Darwin, Marx, Wagner? What is it, this naturalism? Is that what he's getting at?
Well, it was a basic change in the thinking that was tied to naturalism and also to a cult of struggle. Mm. And of sort of warfare. In Marx, it's class warfare, and then in Wagner, it's this heroic adventure and a militarism. I remember a quotation from that book that stayed in many people's minds. It was that the late 19th century, if you read all the ideological formulations, what the philosophers were writing and so on, it's one long cry for blood. Mm. Now, I don't know whether, I buy the whole thesis or yeah. not. It was a brilliant book, but it covers a lot of difficult questions, but fascinating reading.
I probably should have read it.
Yeah.
We're talking with Philip Johnson. Darwin on Trial is his book, and it's co-published by Regnery Gateway or InterVarsity Press. This is a pre-recorded program. Greg Wheatley sitting in for Chris Fabry. So because we're pre-recorded, we cannot invite your calls tonight, but we're going to go back to the phones by way of tape and talk with Lori. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Greg.
You're on the air.
Okay.
Where's Lori from? Lori is from Bartlett, Illinois.
Incorrect. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
I'm calling this evening, and I guess I should give you a little bit about my background. I'm certainly not a scientist. However, I've always had an affection for it and a love of it. I guess I have more of a business background and now turned full-time homemaker and mother, possibly on the verge of homeschooling at this point. However, I've married into a family of scientists. Although my husband's an attorney, both his brothers and father are indeed scientists, atheists, and of course I'm of a very Christian background. I guess what I've been led to most recently has been the question of evolution versus creationism due to the complex questions of my six-year-old son, who is a natural scientist, but also we are trying to train in a Christian home and in a Christian school.
I just love this question.
It's a three-part question. I'll begin. First of all, I'm wondering if the theories presented by Pierre Teilhard de Chardin are ever taught within the framework of a science curriculum. I've talked with my two brother-in-laws, both one of whom is a professor of some type of microbiology and the other who is a high school teacher of physics, and it seems as though some of his ideas, although at some point maybe in high school they had read him, are completely new to them. And just sometimes mind-boggling because they don't even want to even think about it. I'm I'm wondering about that. I'm also wondering, is there anyone who is currently writing in that same vein that Desjardins wrote in with regard to the compatibility of evolution and creationism? And is there anyone with possibly a science and theology and psychology background who is contemplating these issues who I could maybe bring to the attention of my my husband's family? And lastly, do you have any thoughts on Desjardins' theory of our species becoming a species of psychic beings and of us transcending to a very spiritual being?
I'm going to answer that question in terms of Teilhard de Chardin. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin was a Jesuit, a paleontologist, that means a fossil expert and philosopher, who was heavily involved in a lot of the excavations that led to the hominid fossils, as they're called, the ape man, you know, transition ones that are claimed today. One of the ones that he was most heavily involved with, incidentally, was the discovery of Piltdown Man, which after 40 years in the British Museum of proving truth of human evolution turned out to be a fraud. And I'm sorry to say, for those who admire Teilhard, that there is some circumstantial evidence to believe that he was culpably involved in the fraud, although I think it falls short of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But his fingerprints are all over the evidence, one might say, and there are grounds for suspicion. And certainly he definitely was heavily involved in the discovery. That it's a question of with what intent. Now, what Teilhard did is essentially he made a religion out of evolution. He taught that the evolutionary process was the be-all and the end-all, really the equivalent of God, you see, because it was the creative force in the universe. And that through evolution, a man was going to reach higher stages. She said, I think he evolved into a psychic being. That's sort of it. I think it's a story of man evolving into God. It was treated with disdain by the most rigorously materialistic Darwinists. I talk about Teilhard in Chapter 10 of my book. But one of the most prominent of the neo-Darwinists, Dobzhansky, the famous geneticist, had a spiritual cast of mind, and he admired Teilhard and advocated him. So he achieved that degree of acceptance within the inner scientific circle. I don't recommend this approach at all, frankly, as a way of dealing with the science religion question. I think it's going the wrong way. It's making a religion out of evolution, and I think it's a false religion, really, of man evolving into God. I can't be too encouraging about that approach. And I take a very, very different approach in my book, but it's really aimed at people with the problems of this caller.
Lori, does that help you?
It certainly does, and I'm looking forward to reading the book.
Okay, great. Thanks for calling us tonight. All right.
Thank you.
Good night. Philip Johnson, our guest, the author of Darwin on Trial. Philip, we may have a lot of people running out to get this book after tonight, and I'll tell you this, if you can understand all of this, we're trying to keep on a layman's level. We need to take a break. We'll be back with more calls and more on Open Line right after this. Sometimes, as Christians, we have a hard time saying just a flat-out, I don't know. We have a hard time holding things in tension, don't we?
Well, there are at least two different kinds of people on that. I think that some people are relatively comfortable with saying, well, I just don't have the answers to everything, and there are lots of things I don't know, and even some important things, but I have enough faith or enough knowledge, or enough faith and knowledge, to do the things that I have to do, to live the way that I do, and so I can live comfortably in this setting. Other people feel a real need to have a system that answers questions. They're system builders. Now, I think both kinds are necessary, and both kinds have their weaknesses. The system builders always get you into some tangle of an orthodoxy that is too rigid, and it doesn't explain everything, because, well, I think I said to the last caller, the mind of God is unlimited, but the mind of man is very limited, and so the systems are never really adequate. But on the other hand, they do some hard thinking because they're that kind of person, and that contributes to knowledge. So I respect both kinds.
Let's go to Cleveland, Ohio, a WCRF listener. Wayne, you're on the air with us.
Hi. I'm just wondering here. It seems that many creation scientists have come up with physical evidence to support the view of a young Earth and thereby a creator. and the evolutionists have rejected that evidence without even considering it. Therefore, I'm kind of wondering what your evidence you have, and then what chance you have of convincing evolutionists of a creator if your arguments are based more on subjective reasoning rather than physical evidence. And by the way, I believe that radiomagnetic dating is kind of a poor choice for a belief in a 4.5 billion-year-old Earth.
Well, that's fine. By the way, I'd encourage you to write about radioactive dating and to address that position.
There's some pretty good books on it.
It's not that I'm relying on subjective notions instead of evidence. It's simply that I am attacking a different question. I'm attacking the question which seems to me to be the most basic one, which is whether all of these living things that we see, including ourselves, were created by a creator for a purpose. Or, to put it another way, whether science has proved the opposite of that, as they claim to have, in the Darwinistic theory of evolution. So I'm dealing with all of our hard scientific evidence and with all of the logic that's necessary to deal with this, but that, to me, is the most important question and the one I want to deal with. So I'm not going to pick a fight with anybody over the age of the Earth. Yeah, I'll leave that to others to argue about.
But Wayne, let me see if I've got your question right.
Okay.
I don't know if I heard you correctly. You want to know how one who believes in God would prove that?
Well, to me, the creation scientists that are seeking physical evidence for a young Earth, which would automatically refute evolution, they have some kind of a basis to go on. I mean, there's something you can look at and feel and touch. But if your arguments are based on, statistics and a lot of other things that are somewhat subjective in how you interpret them, then, those never seem to convince me. I don't know how they're going to convince anybody else. I guess that's why I don't really see where... I don't understand how he's going to accomplish what he's trying to accomplish.
Is he understanding what you're trying to accomplish, Philip?
Well, I don't know. the gentleman's entitled to his opinion. Maybe he has a better approach than mine. But I am persuading a lot of people, so I feel I've got the right slant, but the gentleman's entitled to a different opinion.
I don't mean to offend you.
No, you don't offend me. Of course you don't.
Do you see your work, Philip, as apologetic in nature for the Christian faith?
It's not fundamentally, although I think it's related to that. And the reason I say it's not fundamentally is because I don't tell you where you should go after you have seen that neo-Darwinism isn't true. You see, somebody could believe everything in my book and be thoroughly convinced and then say, well, I'm going to stay an atheist just like I've always been, and we'll come up with a new theory that explains everything without God maybe in the next century or 500 years from now. That's a sort of an atheist faith commitment. And if people want, I mean, my book doesn't address that. I don't think too many people will do that. It's too much of a strain, and once they start thinking of it as a faith commitment, maybe they'll start wondering whether it's a good faith commitment, and then something will happen. But I'm not doing the job of apologetics. I'm doing the job of showing up some bad science. That may result in people taking a good, hard look at some of the faith questions that they previously sneered at. But that's as far as my book attempts to go.
Wayne, thanks for your call today.
Okay, thank you.
All right, good day. Let's go to Vermontville, Michigan. Hi, Mark.
Hello.
You're on the air with Philip.
Yes, Mr. Johnson, first of all, I'd like to express my appreciation for the type of work you're doing. And I'll start by saying I am a teacher myself, and although I am not a science teacher, I do believe that there is a need in the school system, the public school system in today's schools, to, if not teach a creation science, to at least incorporate a type of science that could act in conjunction with creation. As Mr. Johnson has been explaining, the type in which evolution to a point, to some extent, could be used to explain some of the creation that God has made. But part of my question is, as Christians, I know it's not always easy, we're not always facing the situation, but I know I heard you talking about the Genesis account and how it doesn't necessarily have to be a literal interpretation of that as far as days. And of course, days, I realize, could be a different length of day of back during the creation of Earth as there are in other planets. However, what my question is, how can we not take a, if we don't take a literal interpretation in Genesis, how do we defend when we take a literal interpretation in the rest of the accounts in the Bible?
Okay. Well, you know, I'm very bold about answering questions about, you know, evolution, about the subject that I study. But the really difficult questions of biblical interpretation, and this is one, you know, what do you say in answer to all of these questions about the Bible, is one that I'm going to leave to the people whose profession it is to study and to answer those questions. For me, I will simply say that it does not seem to be a vital question going to the Bible's authority whether the term day is used in a literal sense or in a figurative sense. They are, after all, a day, some of which occurred before the creation of the sun and the moon, which seems to me to be an indication in itself that something out of the ordinary is intended. But I don't, as I said, I don't want to pick a fight with anybody about this issue. If it's really important for people to establish the young age of the earth, to attack the radiometric dating evidence, to bring out any rational considerations that they want to, I'll let them go to it. My job, what I'm doing, is to address the questions of biological evolution and the origin of life. So I'll just stick to that, if I may. Mark, are you satisfied?
Okay, I wasn't exactly just trying to attack his stance as far as the date of the Earth or anything like that. I guess in a way I was just trying to establish where I was going to be in apologetic sense myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure that I'm really against the non-literal interpretation of the days. Like you said, that would be a good explanation. I like that explanation of the length of days being before the creation of the sun and the moon. And but it's just that's a good tool that I think I could use, because therefore it could be a literal interpretation, but just not an ethnocentric view as we consider a day now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a question also of the sense in which it was intended and all of that. I'll just say I have some experience myself with people who have faith crises or people who are considering a conversion, and I have yet to see somebody for whom the age of the earth was a big question, you know, at that point. There's so many other things, you know, the people think the universe seems meaningless to them, or, you know, why is there so much suffering or something. I've never heard of this being a gigantic stumbling block. Maybe it is in some cases, and I haven't encountered it, but I have seen it.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for calling us.
Thank you very
all
much,
right.
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah. Good night, Mark. This is Open Line, and it's a pre-recorded program with author Philip Johnson. He's authored the book Darwin on Trial, and we'll be back with more calls in just a moment. Open Line, we give you something to talk about.
I think that a church that does not pass out a financial statement is a church that is asking for trouble.
That's Radio Pastor Donald Cole, and on our Labor Day broadcast, you'll hear a special Best of Cole program. Tuesday,
again with me, Ma, and again, me.
Improve your voice with a vocal workout. Chris and Carol Beatty give some tips on improving your tone and pitch Tuesday. Wednesday, interracial marriage. It's a controversial issue, but we'll tackle it with Fred and Anita Prince. Thursday, Pastor Cole returns live for Bible questions and answers. And to end the week,
I think I'm rather a conservative person. I'm a homemaker. The glitz and glamour side of it doesn't really appeal to me.
Part two of our broadcast with best-selling author Janetto. All this coming up on Open Line.
We're back on Open Line, a pre-recorded program tonight. Greg Wheatley sitting in for Chris Fabry, and my guest is Philip Johnson, author of Darwin on Trial. Let's go back to the phones and talk with Keith in Plainfield, Illinois, listening to WMBI. Hi, Keith.
Hi. I have a question. Your guest spoke, I thought, earlier. They saw no change in the fossil record. And my question to him would be this. How does he interpret, then, Lucy and the Archaeopteryx?
Yes.
He has changes in the, or not changes.
Well, I didn't say there was no change in the fossil record, but it is a fact, and the orthodox paleontologists, the Darwinists themselves, acknowledge that this stasis is a pervasive phenomenon. That is to say, once something is there,
You don't see it changing by gradual degrees into something else. The specific examples of claimed intermediates in the evolutionary chain, Archaeopteryx and Lucy, are covered in Chapter 6 of my book. And basically, my approach to the fossil evidence is this, that the question isn't whether, if you're already convinced of the truth of the theory, you can find something in the fossil record which, with a, you know, with a good imagination, can be placed somewhere where it could possibly be a transition between one thing and another. That's the method of going out and looking for a confirming example. And if you have thousands of scientists who are told to go out and find something that confirms the theory, and they're promised fame and fortune if they succeed, you know that something's going to be found. But what the true scientific method is to look at all of the evidence and to see, do you see confirmed the predictions that Darwinist theory would be made? And what you see is a very small number of claimed instances of confirmation, all of which are equivocal. Nothing can be positively identified as the ancestor of something else. At most, there are a few things that conceivably could be the ancestors if you assume that ancestors existed. Lucy, for example, is an ape, small-brained, which some of the people who interpret the fossil say it walked upright like a human being. Others doubt this and suggest that, that Lucy had a bent-legged, simian ape-like gait and swung through the trees, had long arms. Given the tremendous bias in favor of finding missing links, which make you a world-famous person if you can do it, I view all of this evidence with a grain of salt. Even if it's, you know, if it's of some value, it's a lonely exception to the general absence of all of those connecting links which Darwinist theory predicted.
We'll have to leave to another program the question of how she got named Lucy.
They were listening to Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, a Beatles song.
Hey, Keith, thanks for your call. All right, good night. I just couldn't resist that. Really? Lucy?
Yeah, that's what discoveries we're doing, as I recall. Yes.
Wow. Okay. Let's go to Westminster, Maryland, and talk with Merritt. Hi, Merritt.
Hello. In view of your response to the last caller's question, I can pretty well anticipate what your response is going to be to my question. I've read that because of the relatively dogmatic way in which evolution is taught in the educational institutions, that the scientific enterprise is in fact hindered. Do you agree or disagree?
Oh, I certainly do. You know, it's the flip side of what the biologists themselves say about evolution. They say it's the grand unifying principle that they all look to. Well, you know, if it's true, that's very good. But if it's false, the Darwinist theory of evolution, at any rate, it's a big distorting factor because everybody has to make sure that whatever they discover, whatever they interpret, is consistent with this really reigning dogma. And so it's distorting. Yes,
I read a story of an anthropologist who was doing some digging in Southeast Asia, and he presented two skeletons which showed an early stage of man's development, but then one of the people to whom he was making the presentation asked if that was all that was found, and then he confessed, no, there was a third skeleton, and in response to the question why he didn't display that, he said, frankly, that it didn't fit the theory.
Well, you know, I don't know that story, and I don't know who that would have been, but in fact, if you hang around scientific people a lot, as I do, all kinds of stories are told in all kinds of fields about how evidence is viewed selectively. Evidence that doesn't fit in with somebody's pet theory is ignored. This kind of thing goes on all the time. Now, in some areas of science, where you have to do repeatable experiments, you see, whatever you claim has to be, somebody else has to be able to do it too, and repeat the experiment, this will all get checked. But there are some things that people don't care to check or aren't very rigorous about checking, and the whole scientific world is willing to go easy on, as it were. And in those, you can really get some slipshod work. Scientists are human just like the rest of us, and we, in all of our professions, law included, certainly, a lot of slipshod work is done.
I do want you to notice, by the way, that I have resisted lawyer jokes today.
Oh, well, that's they can't offend me with that.
Merritt, thank you for calling us. Good night. Let's talk with Bill in Tampa, Florida. Hi, Bill.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to ask, why don't we seem to find in fossil records the remains of humans as they appear today. And I guess along the same lines is, did humans or the animals of today all of a sudden appear as far as the fossils records are concerned? And, you know, kind of when did we show up?
Well, I believe that there are fossils of modern humans, some of which have been somewhat misleadingly labeled as evolutionary intermediates. Cro-Magnon man is an example. My understanding is that that is just a modern human being, but it sort of sounds more spectacular if you call it something else. But so I think that there are fossil remains of modern animals that I don't know what the extent of it is. Another caller asked about this, and I it's making me curious. I'm going to see what I can find
Maybe
out.
There's
about.
Another book in there.
Maybe, you know, there's always more to look into, of course. This is a vast field.
Bill, is that helpful at all?
Yes, thank you.
All right, thanks for calling us. Let's go to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Hi, John.
Hi there.
You're on the air with Philip.
Yeah. Phil, if this animal evolution was or is a real truth or fact, I guess some of it is, but why isn't that happening today to any extent, or with, at least within the time that the first written word, in other words, did it stop evolution?
Well, there are two theories about that, as there are about everything important, because nothing is really known, you see, and it's all speculation. There are always different ways you can answer an important question like that. One school of thought says it is going on today, but it takes so long for anything to happen that it looks to us like everything is just staying the same or going around in circles. A very prominent neo-Darwinist named Julian Huxley wrote a book called Evolution in Action, and he shows you all of these things about minor changes occurring today, and it sort of implies that they're the first steps in a long process that would produce a totally new forms, but this is all complete nonsense. It's these are just cyclical changes that he was describing that go back and forth. That's one possibility, is that the change is occurring, but we don't see, it doesn't appear that way to us because it takes so long for anything to happen and we die too soon. Even 6,000 or 10,000 years isn't very long by these terms. Now, the other theory is that, in fact, it's pretty much come to a stop because everything has reached the end of the road. It's become so specialized that it can't change in any fundamental ways. The possibilities are pretty much exhausted. And that occasionally crops up in the literature. All of these just really show that the true answer is they don't know.
They don't know.
Follow-up question, is there any reference in the Old or New Testament to evolution or fossils, et cetera?
I don't know of any, but somebody will contradict that.
Sure. Okay, John.
Okay,
thanks for calling. Let's see if we can get one more call in here tonight. We're going to talk with Tim in Auburn, Alabama. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is, earlier you've mentioned that a lot of the problem comes when they start a definition. They use a different definition for evolution as they move along.
Yes, I did say that.
I was wondering, is there some way, or in your book maybe you have set down a definition for the specific, you know, like you were saying, molecular evolution as compared to all of a sudden lumping, man from amoebas type thing. That seems like it'd be a lot easier to discuss that for the Christians if there was more specific definitions. If there are some, could you suggest
that? Well, yes. Yeah, so that's one of the things I'm trying to do, is to explain to the readers of the book exactly how each of these terms is used and how the quick shift is made. When my wife and I were talking about this book throughout the writing process, she said that's one of the things I really had to do, was to explain to people how the rhetorical tricks are done. So I would hope that anybody who read the book at least carefully enough would understand the different ways in which the term is used. The term evolution, the term creation, shifting definitions of the term science. We haven't gotten into that, but I do in the book. So that they can't be fooled so easily.